You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM, reporting live for WFHB, this is Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Joe Crawford. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, June 14th, 2016.
We're not looking for leniency for veterans. What we're looking for is to get them the assistance that they need so that they do not become a repeat offender.
We speak with Monroe County's Veterans Service Officer about plans for a new veterans court. More on that later in the show in today's WFHB Community Report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, the ins and outs of money, our weekly segment providing economic education and community resources that keep your budget balanced and your finances flourishing. But first, these local headlines.
The Bloomington Utilities Service Center will not be LEED certified anytime soon. The Utilities Department recently had the building analyzed to see if it could meet the standards set by the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design Program, or LEED. The city's Conservation and Energy Resource Manager, Nolan Hendon, told the Utilities Service Board last night that the cost of silver certification would be high and the return on investment would take longer than 10 years.
The results of that analysis showed that we cannot achieve any LEED certification with a 10-year payback period or less. The initial results of the study did seem to indicate that we could achieve this with a 9.3-year payback. But if you look in the memo I gave you, there's a table of the total cost to achieve that. And it was assumed that all those costs were one-time payments. But in reality, some of those are annual payments. So for example, the one I highlighted in the memo is $11,000 to purchase renewable energy credits to offset our electricity use at this building. That would actually be an annual payment that we'd have to make to maintain our LEED certification. So that cost goes from $11,000 to $110,000, which increases in that 10-year window if we're looking at the total cost, the total cost would make that payback over 22 years.
The four categories of LEED certification are platinum, gold, silver, and simply certified. A 2009 city ordinance in Bloomington requires that existing city buildings undergo an analysis to determine if a LEED silver certification is feasible with a payback period of 10 years or less. Hendon says the certification might be achievable at some point in the future. In the meantime, Hendon said some upgrades have been implemented at the service center to increase energy efficiency, including new heating and air conditioning controls. The HVAC controls had not been upgraded since the building was constructed, with the feasibility study costing $14,000 and the retrofitting costing $35,000. Board member Jason Bannock commented that a high price was paid, only to find out the certification could not be achieved.
I agree that wanting to do this in LEED is a noble thing. I mean, the university now, of course, won't build any new buildings unless we can get it to LEED.
Right.
Gold, I'm pretty sure, at least silver, maybe gold. And so, I just kind of wonder, from the city council's perspective, I mean, this is one of the newer buildings that the city owns. Mm-hmm. And we spent $14,000 to figure out we can't get this building to LEED. I mean, then there's Banneker and all these other buildings. I mean, from the city's perspective, I'm wondering if we really go through spending all that money and all these facilities to figure out we can't get them there. That's editorial, sorry.
Hendon reiterated that staff initially expected LEED certification would be feasible.
In other news from the Utilities Department, Bloomington's water quality coordinator is optimistic that the city has its problems with disinfectant byproducts under control. That's after recent tests to the city's water supply. Long-term exposure to disinfectant byproducts, or DBPs, is linked to health problems, including cancer. Water quality coordinator Rachel Atz says levels of the chemicals recorded in May were lower than they were a year ago.
So that's a good sign to us. We do expect that they will be rising from, you know, April 2016 because the water is warmer than it was last month. But it still is quite a bit lower than it was last year. So it indicates to us that the changes that we're making, that we're moving in the right direction.
The city has seen high levels of disinfectant byproducts recently, particularly during the past year. The byproducts are formed when chlorine interacts with organic material in the water. Levels of DBPs tend to increase during the warmer months. The city hired two consultants to investigate the problem, and earlier this year, the utilities department made changes to the city's water treatment plant, where chlorine is introduced into the water. At said the modifications seem to be having the desired effect.
That's what we're really optimistic about, that the change is what's moving us in the right direction. What's a little too early to tell is how the change is going to be affected by late summer and fall results. We certainly probably won't get the same impact that we saw in April, but we do know that we're going to be lower than, let's say, last October.
Disinfectant byproducts are produced in higher quantities during the late summer and early fall, partly due to the amount of organic material in the water. The utilities department draws water from Monroe Lake. The department serves all of Monroe County and parts of Brown County.
Bloomington Pride is holding a candlelight vigil tonight to honor the victims of the mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. The vigil is set to begin at 7:30 p.m. on the steps in front of City Hall. More than 1,000 people have RSVP'd to the event on Facebook. Leaders from a number of Bloomington and Monroe County organizations are expected to speak. In a statement, Bloomington Pride said, quote, "We'll gather not only to mourn and honor victims of this senseless tragedy, but also to begin the healing process and think about ways we can affect more positive change," unquote. Weather forecasts indicate there is a chance of rain in Bloomington throughout the evening. If the weather's bad, organizers say the event may be moved inside City Hall.
Last week, the Bloomington Police Department released its first publicly available data sets as part of the White House Police Data Initiative, a nationwide effort to build trust between local police and the communities they serve through transparency. Mayor John Hamilton announced Bloomington's participation in early April of this year. BPD is one of the first agencies of its size to participate in the program, joining 55 other departments throughout the country. The Indianapolis Police Department is the only other law enforcement agency in Indiana to sign on so far. The initiative requires departments to provide data for a minimum of 3 areas of police activity. The Bloomington Police Department has committed to providing 10 data sets, including information on employee demographics, citizen complaints, use of force, officer-involved shootings, and hate crime statistics. The first data sets reflect information gathered in the first quarter of 2016 and are expected to be updated on a quarterly basis. The data sets are available online at the City of Bloomington's Be Clear website, data.bloomington.in.gov, in the Public Safety section.
The Indiana Republican Party wrapped up its convention this past weekend, which included the nomination of several candidates for statewide office and the final naming of delegates to be sent to the national convention in July. Elkhart County Prosecutor Curtis Hill won the Republican nomination for state attorney general on Saturday. He'll run against Democrat Lorenzo Arredondo, a retired circuit court judge. Also securing a nomination was Jennifer McCormick, who'll run against Glenda Ritz for school superintendent. Among the many attendees was the vice chair of the Monroe County Republican Party, Ann Collins. Collins is also running for Monroe County treasurer this year. She says this was her first trip to the Indiana convention, and that like many Hoosiers, she didn't understand the process until she got to witness it firsthand.
I have been involved in the Republican Party, but I have not been involved with precinct committeemen and delegates. I don't think the average person knows that the attorney general, the lieutenant governor, the superintendent, that those people aren't appointed. Those people are actually voted in through the delegates, and those delegates were voted in during the primary. This is all new to me. The delegates were voted in, and then those delegates, in a very fair way, are voting for those positions. And so the number one thing I think I would tell our citizens is, do you know? Did you know that this is how the system works? Because I don't think the average Joe knows.
The final list of delegates includes 57 party officials, local officials, and current and former state legislators. 30 delegates are required to vote for the winner of the statewide primary, and the remaining 27 are required to vote for the winner in their respective congressional districts. All 57 delegates will be voting for Donald Trump when the first ballot is taken at the National Convention in Cleveland. Trump won by a comfortable margin statewide and also won in every district of the state. Ann Collins said that even though some people are still on the fence, the GOP seems to be lining up behind the Trump candidacy.
There was still a mixture. The majority of people are getting behind the Republican candidate, Trump, for president. I think most of the Republicans realize that there is no one perfect person to run. And even though there may be a few things that they don't particularly like about Donald Trump, they all know, as far as the way this country needs to go to improve, that he's going to be the one that takes the stare versus Hillary. So the majority of the Republican Party is getting behind Trump and giving him their support.
The delegates being sent to the National Convention do not include anyone from Monroe County. Delegates from the 9th District include State Senator Aaron Houchin, Beth Boyce, and Sheriff Jamie Noel. All are current or former members of the 9th District Republican Committee. The state convention reportedly went off without a hitch, though three delegates from northwestern Indiana were arrested at a hotel bar on Friday night. The three were reportedly intoxicated. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. Nationwide, there are more than 21.5 million veterans, many of whom struggle with PTSD, brain injury or trauma, and drug and alcohol addictions. This combination sometimes leads to problems as veterans reintegrate into civilian life, and some find themselves in court. Monroe County Chief Probation Officer Linda Brady has secured a $64,000 grant from the Indiana Judicial Center to fund the creation of a veterans court in Monroe County that could connect veterans with services targeted to their special needs. For today's WFHB Community Report, I spoke with Mary Elftman, the Veterans Services Coordinator for Monroe County, about the creation of a veterans court. Let's go to that pre-recorded interview now. We're talking today about the proposed establishment of a veterans court in Monroe County. For those unfamiliar with the county's court system, there are already a number of specialty courts in place, drug court, reentry court. Mary, is a supporter of the veterans court, can you explain why you think we should have a court specifically for veterans?
Veterans present with unique issues related to their military service. They come home from wherever they are, and I'm talking all the way back to the Second World War through Korea, Vietnam, and our current conflict in the Middle East, with scars and problems that are related to their military service through post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders. And if we have a court that focuses strictly on the veteran and their service-related conditions, be that substance abuse disorder or anger issues, I think it gives the court system and the court officers a unique perspective on what's happening with that veteran.
Can you speak a little more specifically about what issues veterans face that set them apart from any other kind of offender?
Well, veterans will face extreme anger disorders, anger management disorders with the onset of PTSD, and with those conditions, they many times turn to alcohol or drugs to deal with whatever they have going on. While that is not necessarily unique to veterans, because there are many people who have substance abuse disorders, but your general public doesn't relate that to a post-traumatic stress or an anxiety disorder. situation where without having had that traumatic experience in their lives, there would not be a problem. The veteran might not require the alcohol or the drugs or whatever they're using. So that makes a huge difference.
So what exactly can a veterans court do?
A veterans court can bring together an entire community. And we're talking about judges and court officers and public defenders, people like me, the veterans service organizations, along with the mental health facilities, all in one big room focused on helping the veteran and bringing them back from whatever preface they are standing on. My office would be focused on making sure that they get all the benefits that they require. The mental health people would make sure that they're enrolled in the proper level of counseling or whatever medications might be required. And then the judge and the court officers get a perspective of, without the trauma of a combat situation, maybe the veteran would be better off in a less destructive member of society.
Couldn't they get these services by going through drug court, say, if they have drug issues, or reentry court, or any of the other specialty courts that Monroe County already has in place?
They can get many of them, but without the emphasis on the veterans portion, my office and the other veteran service organizations around town would not necessarily be involved in the process. I don't go to drug court to find out if there are veterans there. If they're registered in the veterans court, then I'm there, or I could be there, and I could be there to immediately take action to get them the care that they needed or the benefits that they needed. Whereas in a drug court, they would have to say it's on the onus of the veteran to come to me at that point, not me sitting down with them on the spot and applying for these benefits and helping them through these problems.
How many veterans do we have in Monroe County?
These are the 2015 census records. For veterans in Monroe County is just under 7,500.
And how is the court being paid for?
I'm involved in helping set it up, but I am not involved in the funding slice. I do know that Linda Brady, Chief Probation Officer, has obtained the funding to begin the startup, and then her and I are working together along with a gentleman named Steve Malone to try to get it to the point where we can start finalizing the plan for it.
Is there any reason to be concerned that a veterans court might show leniency that could affect public safety? By that, I mean, for example, if you're a victim of a crime in which the perpetrator is a veteran, should you be concerned that because there's a special veterans court, the perpetrator won't be appropriately punished?
We're not looking for leniency for veterans. We're just looking to identify them and identify their special problems. If they are actually guilty of a crime, then that crime should be punished in the way that every other crime of like is punished. What we're looking for is to get them the assistance that they need so that they do not become a repeat offender.
This court essentially recognizes that there are certain factors that might lead a person to commit a crime, that there are correlations between traumatic experiences and ending up in court. If we assume that veterans deserve their best shot in the court system, don't others deserve that too? There are people who endure childhood trauma, for example, or sexual abuse or questionable parenting, any number of factors that one might argue could lead to criminal activity later in life. So should the courts, in your opinion, always be aiming to understand the problems that lead a person to be in court in the first place?
Yes, that is something that every person who's in front of a judge is entitled to have the court system understand where they came from. My focus is on, of course, the veteran. So victims of sexual trauma or child abuse, they should also have their avenue, but I'm focused on veteran.
What is the status of the court now?
We are just in the preliminary planning stages. The funding came in, I'm going to say, in April. Linda received funding to hire someone to start the planning process. We're working on getting ours set up to handle this region, because this is actually a regional veteran sport that we will be running here in Monroe County.
I've been speaking with Mary Elfman, the Veteran Service Officer from Monroe County. Mary, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Have a good day.
According to Monroe County's Chief Probation Officer, Linda Brady, before the court can get up and running, it must be certified by the Indiana Judicial Center. Once certified, the Monroe County Veterans Court will also serve Lawrence, Owen, and Greene counties. Coming up next, WFHB's weekly financial segment, The Ins and Outs of Money.
It's The Ins and Outs of Money, presented by the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. Quick tips for getting control of your money, no matter how big or small your income or family is.
Hello, and welcome to The Ins and Outs of Money. I'm Christina with the It's Your Money Project. All right, so working for yourself sounds like a dream job. Even the term freelancer is music to your ears. After all, freelancing means working whenever you want, on whatever you want, and wherever you want, right? Well, maybe. Here are some tips to going from freelancer as a side gig to working for yourself full-time. 1. Treat it like a job. By that, I mean try working from 9 to 5 or similar regular hours. Or, if you're doing freelancing on the side, create a specific time frame in which you are doing just your freelance work. Doing this ensures that if you don't have an active project at the moment, you're working on things like creating future jobs for yourself, or networking, or improving your skills, or collaborating with fellow freelancers. The most successful freelancers do this, and that hard work and devotion tends to bring work more often, increasing your potential for a successful long-term career. 2. Remember your taxes. When you receive your W-2 from your employer every year, you see the total amount deducted from your paycheck for Social Security and Medicare, what are called payroll taxes. And when you work as an employee for someone else, your employer usually matches that amount on your behalf. You and your employer go about 50-50 on payroll taxes. But on income you make as a freelancer, guess who pays your employer's share? Your freelancing employer. You. So as freelancer, you can expect to pay about double, about 15% right now, in payroll taxes. And that's just payroll taxes. You still pay regular federal and state income tax on top of that. Plan accordingly. 3. Don't just work for yourself, be your employee. Don't skip on benefits that you would get from a regular employer. Be sure to get yourself health insurance, even if it's only catastrophic coverage. Open an individual retirement account, an IRA, that you can start contributing to. That's how you build a foundation for a sustainable freelance career. 4. Create relationships. One thing many experienced business people will tell you is that the surest way to new business is through customers you already have. Hiring a freelancer can be risky and expensive for a potential client, so work hard on building great rapport and trust with clients you already have. They'll be your source and your references for new ones. 5. Don't be a yes man or woman. For a new freelancer, it's enticing to make a customer feel like they're right about everything, especially with creative work like design or writing or photography. You want clients to like your work because you want their repeat business, and you also want to feel validated and confident about the job you're doing. It's great and smart to want to please clients, but you also have your reputation to think about. You don't want a portfolio full of inferior work you did because you lost your creative input by saying yes to every idea your clients had. Try to find a sweet spot with customers where they trust your creative advice and still get a product they're happy with. 6. Charge what you're worth and keep those receipts. It's all right to offer discounts when you're first starting to build your client list, but don't underprice yourself. Remember, you have to factor in how much it really costs to be in business for yourself, as well as what really feels fair to you. Research what the going rate is for freelance work in your field. Also, remember to keep your receipts for anything that relates to your work, whether it's a lunch meeting, miles on your car to get to a job, or supplies you use, and keep them for 7 years in case you need them for tax purposes. 7. Reduce your risk. Create a corporation. Corporations aren't always big companies with hundreds of employees. Some freelancers incorporate as an LLC, a limited liability corporation, made up of one person, because of the advantages over doing business as a sole proprietorship. The most important difference is that your corporation, not you as an individual, assumes liability for damages, injuries, and other unforeseen circumstances resulting from your work. That might not sound like a big concern if you're designing wedding invitations as a freelancer, but if you do plumbing or electrical work, it is. So, what do you think, Mr. or Ms.? Freelance accountant, taxidermist, guitar doctor, designer, HR manager, tailor, editor, mechanic, or social media expert? Are you ready for the big leap? If so, don't forget your money smarts.
The Ins and Outs of Money is part of the It's Your Money Project at Monroe County Public Library. It's produced by Ryan Stacey at Level Up, the Digital Creativity Center at the library. Executive producer is Joe Crawford, and Christina Wilty is our associate producer and sound editor. Music courtesy of Flannelgraph Records. Tools for taking control of your money can be found at money.mcpl.info. That's money.mcpl, as in Monroe County Public Library, .info.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jared Dill, Rob Schoon, and myself, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sarah Vaughn.
The Ins and Outs of Money is produced by Ryan Stacey and associate producer Christina Wiltsy. It's part of the It's Your Money project at Monroe County Public Library. Our engineer is Jennifer Brooks. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Joe Crawford. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Joe Crawford. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at wfhb.org.
And you can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.